Welcome to 2023, Scams and Cons fans. I'll be back in a few days to tell you about the fourth season of Scams and Cons. We're making some changes so we can bring you some new, different, and exciting stories, but we'll talk about those later. Right now, I want to talk to you about my favorite, second favorite scam podcast. It's called Scamapalooza. It's produced in Australia and hosted by Nicholas J. Johnson. In addition to being an accomplished podcaster, he's one of Australia's best magicians and humorists. He's done books, speeches, and all the other kinds of things that you'd expect self-promoters like us to do. So why am I telling you about this guy? Well, it's not because he's paying me, although if I'm in Australia, I'll expect 2 free tickets to one of his shows. It's as simple as this. A few years ago, he had to step away from his podcast to become a father and slide into his dream job as a curator of magic. With all that sorted, he's back behind the microphone bringing Scamapalooza back to life. Once you listen to the following episode, I'm confident Scamapalooza will become your second favorite scam podcast as well.
This is Scamapalooza, a podcast about scams, illusions, and why humans are so easily deceived. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. And if you do enjoy the podcast, please leave a review wherever you listen. There has been a weird evolution in the wellness industry. What was once a market dominated by new age, holistic self-care has seen a recent rise in hyper-masculine, ideology-driven bro science. Forget Gwyneth Paltrow's jade vagina eggs. These are health products that advocate eating raw liver, dangerous workouts, and tanning your testicles. On this episode of Scamapalooza, I talk to Dr. Vyom Sharma about what bro science means for men's health and how we think about what it means to be a man. In our conversation, Vyom suggests that bro science advocate, the Liver King, is on steroids, a claim that I thought might be libelous until it was revealed to be true 3 days after we recorded our chat. Vyom knows what he is talking about. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scamapalooza. I just realized this is your second time on the podcast, and the last time you were on the podcast was 6 years ago, and a lot has changed for you in that you have become a public health...
Look, when it comes down to putting things down on bios, I say I'm a health commentator. I suppose that's how I often get described. Basically, just speaking publicly about all things health. 6 years ago, I was doing it to some minor, small extents, you know, giving the occasional kind of public talk once in a while for a company. Or I think at that point, I was still doing Triple R Radio, roughly once a month, I was hosting the show Radiotherapy. But ever since then, a lot's happened. The pandemic happened, which really, I think, accelerated everything for me in terms of speaking publicly about health. Yeah, now people really want to hear about their health.
And are you still practicing as a GP? Can people come and get their temperature checked by you still?
That's all I do. I just aim the little ray gun at their forehead and say, nah, you're good. Still working, certainly working as a doctor in various capacities. So one of the things I'm doing is working at the GP respiratory clinics. So often those people can't get seen by their GPs because of various infection control measures. So they'll come to a GP respiratory clinic. I'm there. I'm also the general practitioner for a bunch of residents in aged care. So I'll pop down to several facilities. So I'm not doing your classic general practice clinic work, but still working as a GP, just in other settings, so to speak.
But which is good. I imagine it would be difficult to be someone who is a health commentator if you're not actually practicing medicine, if you're not actually treating patients and talking to other doctors in a practical sense. If you're just on the outside, I guess it would become hard to do that, right?
It's funny, isn't it? You'd think it'd become hard, and yet there seems to be no lack of people who feel free to be commenting on health without any of that experience. And that's clearly a bit of a jibe at people who represent themselves as experts. But then there's quite sensible people too. So for example, someone like Dr. Norman Swan, who's been a really foremost commentator in Australian health landscape for decades now. He hasn't seen a patient for many decades now. But at least, you know, he's had some training, of course, as a junior doctor and everything else. But, yeah, you see it come through. Who has actually seen patients? Who's had real conversations behind closed doors with people about health and who hasn't? It becomes pretty obvious once you actually hear them speak out loud.
And that's what we're talking about today is health and public conversations about health, specifically men's health, and the fantastic phrase bro science. I first became familiar with bro science, Tucker Carlson, the American, I was going to say journalist, but that's unfair to journalists. The American, well, that's unfair to Americans. Tucker Carlson, who is Tucker Carlson, made a bizarre documentary about, I think it's called The End of Men. And in it, there is a lot of talk about men's health, including the incredible claim that men should be getting their testicles tanned on a regular basis to improve their virility, despite the fact that there is no medical evidence to back that claim up. And please correct me on this, that's probably, if you had to choose whether it was good or bad for your sperm count, tanning your testicles regularly would probably fall under the bad side.
You know,
side,
it's funny,
right?
Yeah, you don't really even need to be a medical professional to be on the right side of that. And yeah, exactly right. that was one of the things from that documentary, which, do we call it a documentary? What the hell was it, you know?
Yeah, I don't know what. It was very strange, very strange.
Yeah. And one of the funny things about Tucker Carlson is, like a lot of commentators of his ilk, they are kind of okay to say things that they don't even necessarily believe in their heart, because it helps sell the kind of broader agenda they have. Like, I think if you took him behind closed doors and asked him, I don't know if he'd believe that crap. But really, it's about the bigger picture, which is that, you know, men are under attack. That's the kind of narrative he's going with. And if part of that is co-opting this, you know, this tanning movement, so to speak, of the perineum area, because those people also sing from the same hymn sheet, then, you know, he's got an ally.
And that seems to be a big part of that type of a public speech, which is to find an enemy and to say these are the bad guys, we're the good guys, do this and you're a good guy, do that and you're a bad guy. You know, there are people that you don't like who are attacking men. I think men are great, therefore everything I say is correct and you should be doing it as well. How does that play out then in a medical sense? How does that, because there's the war on Christmas, you know, like it doesn't have to necessarily be related to health, but I feel like in the health sphere, that idea, that opposition that they try to create with everything is obviously it's harmful, but it also seems to go against the basic idea of science and of medicine, which is not so much that there is good guys and bad guys so much as there are things which are, you know, good for you and things that are healthy and things that aren't.
Yeah, so certainly when we're talking about, well, when we're talking about healthcare and that idea of this enemy, so to speak, which I guess, you know, we've brought up Tucker Carlson and that attack of men, but let's kind of go with that. That comes with certain values that they're trying to protect, so to speak, which is this apparent claimed, you know, demasculinization of men. So as a consequence, the kind of health measures that they start promoting are these, you know, seen as these hyper-masculine measures. So it's really kind of no coincidence that we've seen the rise of the carnivore diet, you know, to the caricatured extent of people like Liver King. I don't know if you know who Liver King is. Nick, do you?
No, I don't.
Okay, right. I mean, this by the way...
Wait, are you saying Liver... Sorry, is that someone's name or is that like
That's the dude's name. So there's a dude. His name is Liver, yep. As in the organ, the Liver King.
Yep.
And he, if you look at him, he just looks like just a giant, like, steroid molecule, basically. Like 0.1% body fat, big bushy beard, walks around barefoot, you know, basically lays that claim, you know, like that... Yeah, men and health was at its peak in the prehistoric era, and he eats liver. Like, he'll eat a lot of raw meat, total carnivore. And he's kind of like this almost like this caricature of this, you know, this carnivore only kind of diet movement that's emerged over the last several years. And again, it's so clearly linked to that social movement of, well, masculinity is under attack, so we need to be more masculine in every way. So it comes down to eating meat because it involves killing people and stop people. Okay, no, that kind of meat. Who knows?
Vyom Sharma says eating meat must involve murder.
So you've got, which is, you know, in complete opposition to the vegan movement, right? Which is that we must preserve life. And also the kind of exercises that this guy is promoting is, you know, these extremely hypertrophy-focused, kind of strength-focused exercises. And again, if we talk about what you said earlier, which is that's not how science works, which is we're trying to, you know, find truth wherever it lies, they're trying to find, you know, elements of truth within this very narrow domain of, well, what's the most masculine thing, so to speak, that we can do, and where are the bits of truth within that domain? And of course, if you try to find truth through those filters, you're only going to get part of the picture.
And that, I mean, in the case of bro science, it does seem to grow out of gyms. Like, that seems to be where these, you know, people like him seem to thrive. Like, this is essentially a kind of, sure, it's diet related, but it sounds like he is a guy who is saying you also need to work out and you need to lift weights and you need to do your ropes and your, you know, medicine ball. I've forgotten the name. I go to the gym 3 times a week and I've just forgotten the name of every single piece of gym equipment in the gym. I'm struggling to name any of them. But it's like it feels like that's the place where a lot of this kind of bro science like grows out of. Like, it's, I mean, obviously there's, you know, podcasts, there's YouTube, there's all of those things, but you have this kind of space where particular, you know, men with perhaps those kind of attitudes will congregate and be able to kind of share that type of idea.
And I actually think there are some really good and positive and healthy reasons why a lot of that, the bro science has emanated from the gyms. You know, we have to take into account that actually the science of fitness and exercise and nutrition is actually being really quite immature and poorly conducted, even by a kind of mainstream medicine. So we have to lead with that concession. On the other hand, you know, when you look at gyms, particularly through the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, that kind of golden era, you've got like about as empirical as evidence you can have of people who said they wanted to be healthy and they, you know, got results, whatever you call them. And many of those people, you know, we're obviously bodybuilders and get visual results, so to speak. And so you obviously think, well, this has got to be the source of truth on how to be healthier. And the reality is that that's often somewhat true, right? Like there are some truths that have been discovered in the gym when it comes to men's health in this really empirical manner. But the problem is, of course, that there are some good and narrow truths. But when they get generalized very broadly in a way that, you know, that maybe doesn't apply to everyone or in every single way, that's when you kind of have problems. Yeah, bodybuilders are really good at getting, firstly, generally speaking, stronger, but also, you know, volume-wise and bigger. How much does that actually translate to any and all domains of health? That's pretty dubious, and it's varied, and sometimes it does, and sometimes it does not. But hey, when that becomes your source of truth, that's it. But yeah, look, I think gyms, you know, provide this very visual result to people at a time when, you know, which is to say the last couple of decades, when there actually hasn't been a lot of empirical factual truth about health and fitness coming out from the medical industry because we're being focused on, you know, other aspects, I think.
You talked there a lot about the visual, I've forgotten the exact phrase you used, but you talked about the kind of visual benefits, the fact that people coming out of gyms and they look fit. You know, they are people who come out and they look ripped and they've got big muscles. I've just looked up the Liver King while we've been talking, and he's got, you know, like you said, yeah, he looks like a like a bunch of walnuts stuffed into a condom. Like, it's, you know, extraordinary, like ridiculous body. That is, you know, like I'm not. I think it's probably the result of something other than.
Guaranteed. Like, I mean, he'll maintain that he's not, as we say, enhanced. But my God, like, you would test positive to steroids from being in the same room with him. Like, this guy absolutely. You're putting anything and everything into his body to look like that. And again, part of the problem is, of course, he's not upfront with that at all. He's often evasive and will lie. That's a big thing. Sorry, go on.
And I think when, and it seems like, and this is not something that is restricted to bro science and men's health in particular, but there is a big part of this seems to be the appearance of, both health and the appearance of masculinity, that it isn't like I go to the gym regularly and I'm quite strong and but I also don't eat particularly, you know, I don't weigh myself and I'm not really interested in looking like this guy. And so I don't look like a particularly fit, strong person like you would imagine. Because that's not really my focus when I exercise. But it seems though that a lot of this is performative, that a lot of it feels like it doesn't actually matter how strong I am or how strong I feel, or as you said, all of these other, you know, health domains, it's how I appear is the most important thing. Like, do I look and appear to be this idea of a hyper masculine, you know, male? And that seems to be really where the focus is with a lot of this bro science. Like, how do you appear to other people and how do you demonstrate and perform, you know, that idea to other people?
Yeah, that's definitely where most of the focus, I think, is, either explicitly or implicitly on the aesthetic side of health. And yeah, part of that is, of course, well, you know, it's the bit that's easiest to assess, right? You look at someone or you look at yourself, there it is. There's all the kind of data you need to make an aesthetic assessment. But, you know, make an assessment about someone's metabolic health, that's complicated. What parameters are we looking at? How do you measure that through the various tests, etc.? You know, there are things that contribute to it that you can't change, like your genetic history, your family medical history, everything from mental health to focus and mood, all those things, they're quite difficult to measure and represent externally, be it through images and social media than the other. So there's that side of it. But then there's also just the side of it that is, as it turns out, something we value highly as a society, how quote-unquote good you look. So you kind of have this perfect confluence of societal values, which are quite dubious, versus the fact that assessing someone's aesthetics or yourself is incredibly easy to do. And then, yeah, you end up with this kind of vicious cycle of everything endlessly being about aesthetics. So, yeah, it's a huge trap. And there are other domains that bro science does try to kind of explore. There's a little bit of that happening at the moment. But so much of the conversation and efforts almost always just kind of come back to aesthetics time and time again, which is, like we said, you know, just one of the domains.
You mentioned the things which are difficult to measure, and it does seem, and I think this is probably true across health in general, that we do really focus on things which are easy to measure and things which are easy to see when it comes to health. So how much you weigh when you get on the scale, that's very easy to measure, whereas other things you mentioned, like sleep, for example, is very hard to measure. And even when you do measure it, those results are quite hard to understand.
Yeah,
you know, it's quite difficult to actually say, exactly. So I ignore my sleep and just go, yeah, but when I get on the scale, I got this number and it's 5 kilograms less than it was a few months ago. Therefore, I'm fitter and a better person and worthy of love. all the things that come with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Because everything else, all the other domains are, like we said, for all the reasons you mentioned, are a bit fuzzier, they can be typically a little bit harder to control. And in fact, in some ways, I think some of those other domains of health, the hard part is that you don't have as much control on it as you'd like to have. I mean, you know, weight is hard enough to control, but you know, my goodness, you know, your long-term mental health, that's something, you know, for some of us, there's actually nowhere near as much control over that as we'd like to have. Your metabolic health, so things like, you know, your blood pressure, your sensitivity to insulin, your blood glucose levels, again, all those things harder to measure, difficult to control over the long term in a way that, and again, it's quite tricky to control weight, but you know, in the short term at least, it's much easier to get control of your weight per se by pulling all the levers available to you, as opposed to all those other domains we've mentioned, and sleep and glucose and mental health, all those things.
Someone suggested that I needed more magnesium, and this was like a random non-health professional said, you should consider having more magnesium, taking magnesium supplements. And I'm someone who's very suspicious of random advice, particularly when it comes to, you know, supplements of any sort. So I looked up what the research said, and it's sort of agreed that, yeah, that might be useful for me in this situation. So I started asking people, and who are, you know, different medical professionals, you know, like, who did I ask? I asked you, and I asked my doctor, my GP, and I have a psychiatrist that I see every 6 months, and I asked her and all these different people, and no one could say, yes, you should take magnesium supplements. No one could sort of say, that's a good thing that will be useful for you to have. And it was basically because there wasn't really any way of knowing for sure whether it was something that I needed. And in the end, my GP just goes, well, just take it and, you know, see how you feel. And that was it. And I kind of go, I think I feel better. Could be a placebo, might not be. Mm. And even though I still take it and I'm pretty sure that it helps, I'm not getting that feeling of security that I would like from the medical community. Mm. And so I can see why people would be attracted to, particularly perhaps people who feel very uncertain when it comes to things like masculinity and so on. But having a guy who like looks like the liver king and who comes in and goes, eat liver, lift weights, suck it up, be a man, that true or false, like would just be very comforting.
Massively. So supplements are a huge aspect of the bro science industry. Either directly because people will, you know, kind of extol the virtues of, you know, the mineral or vitamin du jour, and at the moment it is magnesium, or because...
Oh, so wait, so I'm on the, this is like a, I'm part of a trend
Magnesium is popping off, and you ride the wave, my friend, yeah.
Wow, I didn't realize, I'm not normally like, you know, on the zeitgeist, so I feel pretty cool. I'm going to go tell my kids so they think I'm, hey guys, if you're upset, I'm cool because I take, you know, those disgusting magnesium things I have in the morning? Yeah. No, they make me cool.
That's it.
Look, kids, I'm flossing. All right.
Oh, God. Look, it's funny how you've kind of told the story of magnesium here. Someone told you about it. You then tried to go to trusted sources of information who couldn't give you a straight answer. And that's absolutely what's happening for you now. But you kind of step back from that. If you look at it from my perspective as a health professional, this happens every 2 or 3 years, and there will be a new supplement or whatever it is that kind of comes along that is popular at that moment. And then it'll just kind of fade back into obscurity, and now no one's talking, right? The reason these things happen is you'll occasionally get a study that'll come out, like that, you know, that one study that shows, generally speaking, kind of positive results. And for, you know, the listeners who are familiar with science, the key thing we're looking for, if one study says, you know, this supplement works, is we're looking for replication. We're looking to see, are multiple studies proving this correct in the same way? The point is, though, that once you've made that initial discovery that, hey, this thing might work, there's really no incentive for anyone to check, really, because if you're doing the checking work by replicating the study, you're not actually investigating something new and interesting. You're just revisiting something old. And, you know, what's new and exciting in the world of science is, you know, really where all the the funding and the kudos kind of goes. So you'll get an element of truth, right? It'll often get kind of extolled by some big figure in bro science, and you know, anyone from medical people like Peter Attia to one of the really popular, you know, YouTubers or someone will talk about it. Filters down from person to person, you know, the friends you work out with in the gym, whatever. And then it kind of filters down to you. Then as medical professionals, we hear about it. Of course, you know, there's those studies, et cetera, they never really kind of get replicated. And then, you know, inevitably we move on to a few years later to the next thing. So the reality is there just isn't actually enough data. We, in the same way that I can look at the vaccine data and go, yes, this has been proven through, you know, various phases of trials and really large trials and internationally conducted and matching up with real life evidence. We're never going to get that level of certainty with these supplements. And as a result, you know, doctors like me will speak about it in kind of soft ways to go, not really aware of any evidence. Even if I look it up, you know, we're finding kind of conflicting, really weak levels of evidence. So really, how much certainty can your doctor give you? It's not much. On the other hand, you know, like your mate can give you a lot of certainty, and you know, the power of anecdote is so incredibly powerful. It's if it worked for me, that is a very powerful story to tell. And I really think this is how bro science kind of proliferates. Really, there's no kind of grand conspiracy going on amongst these people. It's just everyone's trying to find the truth. You know, the level of certainty out there is actually quite low. You take people seriously on their words. You take the guy who's jacked at the gym, like, if he says it, then, you know, gosh, I wonder if it's more likely to be true. And then, yeah, and we're all just kind of wading through this soup of bro science knowledge. You know, a lot of it bullshit. But yeah, as a result, you don't really get a lot of certainty out of medical professionals, because we're looking for high quality. To be honest, we rarely find it.
Is there a difference between bro science, which is this sort of hypermasculine science, and whatever, I don't know if there is a name for it, but perhaps the sort of feminine, I guess, would be the opposite version of it, female version of, or women's version of this type of science? I guess Goop would maybe be where I would go for the flip side.
I think that the industry that targets and that women engage with most is, we'd call it the wellness industry. That is almost entirely, has a very feminine aesthetic. Everything from the colors those blogs will use to the language that is used. It's obviously very stereotyped. Like, I'm not suggesting for a second that's what all women are like, but that's certainly the audience that they play to with that aesthetic. So I think in the same way that the wellness industry has a more kind of feminine appeal, bro science and affiliated industries have a much more masculine target, I suppose.
And it's worth noting, we're talking here about two ends of a spectrum. Someone like me, who perhaps I am a man and I am interested in men's health because I have a male body as I, you know, move through the world, that it's very easy for someone like me to go, well, bro science doesn't affect me because I am not eating raw liver and carrying chains around in the forest shouting about feminism is ruining the world. Those things don't affect me. When in fact they probably do in more subtle ways. Like, there is probably subtle ways which I, as you know, am being affected by some of these messages about men's health without necessarily realizing that's what's happening.
Totally with you. Like, I certainly wouldn't consciously associate myself with that imagery you've evoked of walking through the forest shouting about women. But certainly, for example, the aesthetic that industry promotes, or the specific, you know, types and domains of fitnesses that it kind of values and overvalues. I find all the time I'll have a moment when I'm thinking about my own health that becomes the barometer against which I'm judging myself. And yeah, and I think it's really great point you brought up, that just because on a conscious level we don't agree with many of the messages there, that doesn't mean that it's not having some subconscious effect on our programming, for sure. So I'll definitely think about everything from, like, you know, my muscularity to my raw strength, etc. And that's often got roots in what we see in bro science culture kind of evolve. And, you know, I think even kind of calling it bro science culture might be a little bit too narrow, but just how culturally speaking men think about health. One of them is this hyper-aesthetic, you know, pro-masculine way of thinking, which again has some good aspects to it, but many overemphasized unhealthy ones, the aesthetics being one of them, which is completely overvalued. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I spent probably 15 years of my life, almost 20 years of my life going, lose weight, get ripped, that's it. You know, that was my healthcare considerations. That's what I was thinking about. Like, oh, if something goes wrong, I'll go to the doctor. But aside from that, I'm going to stop being fat because then I'll be a good person and then I'll get ripped and that will make me a good person. You know, that's what will happen. And I was thinking about it. My weight's gone up and down over the years, mm-hmm. but I've never had a time where I've been like, my weight has been low, where I can't think of a single time where my weight's been low where I've thought, oh yeah, I'm feeling really healthy at the moment. Mm. Like I'm sleeping well, or I'm, you know, but it's just, you know, mental health. No, I'll ignore that until it completely crumbles. You know, like sleep. No, that's not important. All of those things. And you suddenly go, oh wait, like, yeah, there is such a narrow, you know, you still, despite thinking of myself as a fairly enlightened, you know, 21st century guy, I'm still falling into that same trap of like, you know, it's all about being ripped and being strong and being dominant, I think was a word you mentioned before, like, you know, being able to control your world and control your body to show that you're in charge.
Absolutely. And I think you've touched on something really subtle there, which I hope people are going to pick up on, which is you can on a conscious level be enlightened, right? On a conscious level, we can all say the right things about, well, I don't think about my health in this narrow, superficial way that you described of lose weight, get ripped. And yet on a subconscious level, in a way that we'd never verbalize, that's often the template of health that we will still carry. And it's so important for us to check in with that, where a lot of those feelings arise of shame and guilt and the kind of health that we kind of aspire towards, that we feel deep inside ourselves. Often you'll see that actually doesn't match with the conscious language we use when we're otherwise, you know, at our most kind of enlightened. So I think there's a lot to be said for a lot of the deprogramming that needs to be done. The second thing you just mentioned about being kind of dominant in these ways. It often doesn't just come down to being bro science. The concept of wanting to be dominant and that being a driving value of health in the domain of bro science, it doesn't always just come down to physical health. It's often also about the way that bro science looks at mental health and psychological health. So you'll see a lot of social media algorithmically is also about increasing your productivity to get the most, to be the most focused you can be. To kind of achieve the best and maximize this, control this, all these words like maximize, achieve, control, like even when it comes to your psychological well-being, it's all just about being 10, 11 out of 10 at every chance, as opposed to, for example, how the wellness industry, which as we discussed has a much more female-centric kind of focus in a completely stereotyped way, of course, is often not so obsessed with this concept of control and maximization. That's about harmony and feeling good and heaven forbid. So yeah, even when it comes to men's health being discussed on a psychological and emotional and kind of mood and affect based level, it's so often just about maximizing, going all the way out, as opposed to some, you know, more holistic sense of well-being.
Yeah, and I've noticed in recent years there's been a big push towards stoicism, both stoicism as just a word that people use, but also the philosophical school itself and how confusing the tenets of Stoicism, confusing that with this idea of, as you said, kind of control and productivity and being able to suffer through the indignities and pain and so on of life, suffering through life and not asking for help at all. But it's still kind of been rebranded as you said, like as a tool of productivity. I think there is an entire episode just on the productivity industry when it comes to deception and this idea we're kind of fooled into thinking that being productive is firstly a good way to live your life, like to be constantly productive, and also that productivity is our responsibility, you know, that you know, and not perhaps the organizations we work for and with. But that's a whole other episode, I think.
And yet it ties in so well with everything we're talking about in terms of to bro science. I mean, that's certainly where they've kind of started to shift their attention. And you know, it's going for a specific kind of type of man. Like if you look at the cultural heroes we've got at this point for many young men, for better or worse, and generally worse, it's the Mark Zuckerbergs, it is the Elon Musks, it is look at what Elon Musk has sent out in that email just recently in terms of conversations about productivity. He wants his staff to be, I'm quoting here, extremely hardcore. When it comes to their work. And yet, you know, if these are the kind of cultural heroes that we have at this point of men succeeding in the world, yeah, it's just this very unrealistic expectation, and it makes for, coming back to what we're really talking about here, poor physical health, really, and how that's actually likely to impact you on the, both the short term and the long term, this idea that you need to be kind of endlessly productive to this completely unrealistic level.
Yeah, and it seems as if I am incapable, and I mean, look, I am a self-employed magician and podcaster, and so the most of the ladies, but I mean, all of the pressures in my life to be productive come from me. And I think for me, if I fail, like if I was working for Twitter, you know, because I know they need magicians and podcasters there, they like they've lost a lot of their magicians / podcasters, you know, / children's authors. They've got barely any left. That if they hired me and were saying, okay, pull these 60-hour, 70-hour weeks and work this, and I found myself unable to do that, both I and the organization would paint that as a failure by me. That I wasn't hardcore enough, as he said, or fit enough or productive enough. And if I could just make myself fitter and more productive and better, then I would be able to sort of take everything that is being thrown at
me. And yet none of that language is ever applied back to workplaces. How do we make, you know, the structure of the organization fitter and better and more resilient? You know, why can't the workforce cope? The organization cope, rather, if one employee is sick? Why can't the entire structure cope with this? And yeah, it's almost entirely reliant on individuals going far beyond what we should expect of them. And there's no concept of redundancy in terms of capacity built into a lot of these modern organizations. They are, you know, predicated upon every employee working to their absolute limits. What will kill you? We'll back it off a little bit. That's how intense things are going to be. So, you know, this could be a really potentially watching the demise of Twitter unfold before us. It could provide a really great opportunity, I think, to talk about health and well-being in these hyper-masculine environments. Like who would argue that what Elon Musk is doing is, you could not argue that this wasn't exactly what the hyper-masculine preaching of productivity is all about, and we're seeing it crumble right in front of our eyes. So I hope this is going to drive a lot of conversation forwards in amongst employees, employers, and workplaces in the months and years to come.
So what you're saying is the workers should rise up and take control of the means of production?
I'm surprised it took us this long into the podcast to arrive at that conclusion, really.
Well, we had to go through the wellness industry first before before overthrowing capitalism and the patriarchy at the same time. I think Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Bjorn, for the chat. I think the big takeaways for me from our discussion is that no one, you know, particularly men, is immune from bro science or the type of science that bro science is, that we can all kind of fall victim to it. And also we need to start getting our environments to take responsibility for our health just as much as we take responsibility ourselves.
Indeed. It's absolutely spot on. I couldn't have said it better myself, and I'm going to go to Kmart now and get the T-shirts printed with that on as the slogan.
I hope you enjoyed the show. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit conman.com.au for more. Plus, there'll be a link in the show notes. And Nicholas, you can leave the tickets at the will call window.
True terrors of horror, bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, terror takes center stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, stay safe out there.